Hello everyone, and welcome to Cure Talks for a discussion on multiple myeloma. I am Priya Menon, Scientific Media Editor at Cure Talks, joining you from India, and I extend a warm welcome to all of you this evening. This is Cure Talks 74th episode. We are excited to inform our audience the launch of our new website. Please do visit us at www.curetalks.com. And do send in your feedback to priya@trilex.com. On our myeloma broadcast today, we are discussing ASH 2014 myeloma updates. My co-host for the show is myeloma survivor and editor of myelomasurvival.com, Gary Peterson. On the panel are myeloma advocates and survivors, Pat Killingsworth, Cynthia Schmilewski, and Jack Ayler. We have with us today Dr. Parameshwaran Hari from Medical College of Wisconsin. Welcome to the show, Dr. Hari. It's a pleasure to have you with us once again.
Hi, thank you, Priya.
Gary Peterson will introduce us to our expert and begin with the discussion. Before I hand over to Gary, I would like to tell all listeners that we will be addressing questions towards the end of the show. And if you want to ask a question to our panel, you can press 1 on your keypad. And we will bring you on air to ask your question. Ultimately, you can email me with your question at priya@trilex.com. With that, it's over to Gary. Gary, you're on air.
Thank you very much, Priya. And I've visited your new website, and it is very good. People should go see CureTalk's brand new website. But today, I'm here to talk with Dr. Parameshwaran Hari about the ASH 2014. And on the panel, not only was Dr. Hari there, which I had an opportunity the first time to meet and was so pleased to do that, but all of the other members of this panel, Cindy, Jack, and Pat, were there as well. So it should be a relatively informed group. Dr. Hari is an MD, an MRCP, and an MS. And what that MRCP, I had to Google it, is a membership of the Royal Colleges of Physicians of the United Kingdom. And MS is a Master of Surgery, at least I believe it is. Dr. Hari currently practices at Froedtert, and the Medical College of Wisconsin, specializing in hematology, oncology, and hematologic malignancies. Since 2004, he's been serving as the director of the Adult Blood and Marrow Transplant Program at Froedtert, and he's also a section head of hematology, malignancies, and transplantation. He's a scientific director for the CIBMTR, which is a group of hospitals which number about 500 that report all of and have an organization that reports on stem cell transplants, both autologous and the other one I can't bring it to mind right now. Auto and allo. Yeah. I'll just leave it at that. And it works with those plasma cell disorders and adult solid tumor working committee. He's also 2014 Myeloma Multiple Myeloma Survivorship Conference Chairman. He received his education and his MD at Jawaharlal Institute of Postgraduate Medicine in India, which is one of the three top medical schools in India, kind of like the Harvard, Mayo, or one of our better ones as well. He then completed his fellowship in internal medicine and hematology at the Royal College of Physicians and Royal College of Pathologists in the United Kingdom, and in the medical oncology and transplantation at the Medical College of Wisconsin. He has many peer-reviewed publications. He is also multilingual. He speaks 5 different languages. The Medical College of Wisconsin happens to be, and Dr. Parameshwaran's Hari's program happens to, he provided me with the survival statistics for myelomasurvival.com, and his three-year survival is 93.8% versus the SEER data of 55.6. And this is this is one of the two best performances for myeloma survival in the entire world. So I think it's a remarkable performance, and it's such a find for a center that is not that well known outside of Wisconsin. They have myeloma patient population of over 1,000, and I think Milwaukee's little myeloma treasure is no longer their little secret. And as a matter of fact, you know, I think that you know, it deserves to be in the same language and sentences with UAMS, Dana-Farber, Mayo Clinic, etc. So with that, I want to try something here. It's one of the languages Dr. Hari knows. Kulu kunapatula tuta vira virkuruma, which is supposed to mean welcome to Cure Panel in Tamil. Wasn't even close, was it, Doctor?
No, I kind of figured it. It's my mother tongue. That's okay.
Better in English, huh?
Yeah.
Well, welcome to the program, Dr. Hari.
Thank you, Gary.
I even practiced.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate all the effort you take on behalf of everyone who's dealing with myeloma. Just the effort to go to my history was remarkable there, yeah.
Well, welcome. And I know that you went to ASH, and based on your observations, I'd like to ask you what you believe the state of myeloma is, kind of the state of the union, but for myeloma. And you might break that down into four different categories. And, you know, if you forget any of the categories as we go through it, just let me know and I'll repeat
sure.
it. You know, the first one is for all those existing first the existing newly diagnosed patients that are looking for first-line therapies, and what was represented at ASH that would be exciting for those. The second one would be existing approved drugs for relapse refractory myeloma patients for both high and low risk, you know, using like Kyprolis and Pomalyst. And then new drugs which will be approved in the near future for newly diagnosed and relapse and refractory multiple myeloma patients such as SAR and daratumumab. And then finally, any research which you might see on the horizon which may be helpful for either measurement, early diagnosis, early intervention, or possibly new pathways. So, you know, if you could kind of follow that outline.
Sure.
You have the chair, Dr. Hari, and thank you so much. And it was a pleasure getting to meet you.
Oh, thank you, Gary. Thanks, everyone. Thank you to all the people listening, and thank you, Priya, for this opportunity. We'll talk about this. The state of myeloma in maybe the four buckets that Gary so nicely summarized. So first of all, let's think about newly diagnosed myeloma. So the outcome for patients with newly diagnosed myeloma is getting better and better. But as we all know, myeloma is not one disease. It is probably multiple different diseases with varying risk profiles. So from the two of the largest studies that were done with people who had initial diagnosis and then treatment with what we call novel agents, which means including lenalidomide or Revlimid and bortezomib or Velcade, then followed by transplant, followed by maintenance. That's the standard approach for patients who are transplant eligible. So for that type of approach, we think the first remission usually lasts 4 years or so for most people, and that's the state of things as they stand. So there are many ways of making this number go better. The people who do not benefit that much from this type of approach are the people who have high-risk disease. Now, high-risk is defined by a combination of cytogenetics, or, you know, the genetic markers on the top, on the myeloma cells, There are many ways of doing that now, but the most common way still remains something called FISH test. There are other techniques also. For people with high-risk genetics, people who are of older age, people who have kidney failure that prohibits intense treatment, all of those people, the outcomes have not kept up with the patient, with the other standard risk patients. So there are many ways of making this better. So so first of all, you know, how do we make the overall outcomes better? So recently, about a month ago, there was this study published from Dr. Pilimbo's group in Italy, where they randomized patients to, after giving initial therapy with lenalidomide and dexamethasone, patients either got two transplants or they got melphalan and prednisone and Revlimid orally for 9 months, then followed by maintenance. And half the people got maintenance, half didn't. So here, again, the role of transplant was established as being crucial to prolonging the survival of the patients and especially the progression-free survival. So we know that even in the modern era with all these drugs, transplant still continues to be one of the backbones of treatment. So that's that being said, how can we make the initial therapy better, the first treatments that you get better before transplant? So the reason for thinking in those lines is at this time, the three-drug approach is what we use across the country, and the three drugs are going to be proteasome inhibitor, i.e. Velcade, then Revlimid, which is an IMID, and then dexamethasone. So there was a study called the Evolution Study where we did these three drugs versus another three-drug combination with Velcade, cyclophosphamide or Cytoxan, and dexamethasone versus a four-drug combination where we added Cytoxan and Revlimid together to the Velcade-dexamethasone backbone. So three drugs one way, three drugs another way, and all four drugs together. We found that the four drugs, that particular four-drug combination was no better than the three-drug combination, and the three-drug combinations were mutually equal. So that's how this three-drug approach became standard. So for the last 4 or 5 years, that has spread across the country, at least here in the U.S., that's the standard approach for younger patients with myeloma who are transplant eligible. Even older patients benefit from it, but they would need some dose adjustment so that, you know, the doses are not at the same level. A bunch of new developments have happened in this initial induction phase. One is using newer proteasome inhibitors. So we have the new proteasome inhibitor, carfilzomib or Kyprolis. So Dr. Jakubowiak's group did a combination of Kyprolis with lenalidomide and dexamethasone, or KRD, and they showed similar or even better results compared with the Velcade Revlimid dexamethasone combination. So that's one important achievement. And these patients had deep molecular responses with MRD negativity to a level that we have not seen with any other induction treatment. Then Dr. Kumar and his in a multi-center group, many centers participated, including our own, led a study where ixazomib, another proteasome inhibitor, which is an oral form of boronic acid type of proteasome inhibitor similar to Velcade, but it's an oral drug you take 1 day per week. So 1 day per week of ixazomib, every day of Revlimid, and then dexamethasone once a week. That combination also had a dramatic initial response rates, but then Dr. Kumar updated the results of the study at ASH this year, and he showed what happens if you continued with the treatment, if you continued with the ixazomib orally as maintenance treatment afterwards. So that was very interesting, up to 48% of patients. So that means about 50% of patients increased their responses while on this maintenance treatment with ixazomib, which means that the complete response rates went up from about 25% at the end of 8 cycles to about 62% while they were on maintenance. So that's amazing. You know, 62% complete response is a very dramatic, good result in this setting. So that's one thing. So we can say that the three-drug combinations are getting better, and we have new three-drug combinations that might become standard. So that's number one for newly diagnosed disease. Number two, we are still exploring four-drug combinations. You know, ultimately, most people believe that this approach of using non-cross-resistant drugs, drugs that do not mutually interfere with each other and they augment each other, those type of combinations are going to be the future of myeloma. So the non-cross-resistant combinations of four drugs are again gaining traction. So there was a small study, about 22 patients study, with the RVD or Velcade Revlimid Dexamethasone plus a new drug HDAC inhibitor, HDAC inhibitor called Panobinostat, added to that combination. So in that, the results are not mature yet, but again, the overall response rate was 95%, suggesting that almost everyone who got this combination responded. This was newly diagnosed patients. And the study is still ongoing, and the doses are not set yet, so this will be a, you know, like watch this space type of thing. Then we have some other combinations that have that are being explored again, you know, cyclophosphamide, carfilzomib, and dexamethasone, or CCD. This has some attraction for people in Europe because they, with cost being a big issue there, they're unlikely to get too expensive oral medications or too expensive medications to combine. Cyclophosphamide is a cheaper, very effective drug, has been around for many, many years. So their combination is cyclophosphamide, carfilzomib, dexamethasone. Then there is Velcade, pomalidomide, dexamethasone, a different proteasome inhibitor plus IMiD combination, similar to RVD, but again, you know, with, then Europeans again presented a combination of carfilzomib or Kyprolis with thalidomide and dexamethasone. So all of these are excellent new combinations that are being derived. And the three drugs, so in summary, we could say that the more potent the drugs and the less toxic the drugs, the more likely people are able to continue with treatment for longer duration. And we can actually get greater responses and deeper responses with the more potent combinations. We hope that this will translate. Yeah.
Kyprolis and Pomalyst and that inhibitor that you had talked about, all of those have yet to be approved. Have they? Or are they, you know, I know Kyprolis and Pomalyst have been approved, but only for a relapse refractory. Is that correct?
That's correct.
You know, so people can't really take that as newly diagnosed until they get approved for initial treatment or
on a trial. They can take it on a trial.
Like,
so there's a national trial right now.
Could they do it?
Yeah, we can do it on a trial. The national trial of the ECOG, there's a national intergroup trial that's ongoing right now where newly diagnosed patients are randomized to getting Velcade, Revlimid, and dexamethasone versus Kyprolis, Revlimid, and dexamethasone. That's ongoing right now. So right now we have access to that combination, yeah.
Okay, but not every, your local...
Yeah, it would be 50-50.
Hematology, oncology, colleges couldn't do it, could they?
Well, this is a national trial, so even community practices should be able to join that trial. I think, you know, it's something that everyone should be thinking about, yeah.
Okay. That was it. Sorry to barge in.
No, that's okay. You know, please feel free to stop me in the middle. And then the second thing, you know, the second group that Gary wanted me to talk about, so that was first-line therapy is getting better. And when you get first-line therapy is getting better, everybody benefits. You get more people into complete response. The responses last longer. You get people into deep molecular responses. The relapse rates go down. So, you know, the benefits of initial therapy cannot be overstated. And that's your best shot at dealing with this. You know, once relapse starts, our therapies are generally less effective than they are at the beginning. So we really need to work on getting these initial therapies really, really the strongest we can get them with the least toxicity. Now, the second group that we want to talk about are existing approved drugs for relapse refractory myeloma. As you all know, the last two drugs to get approved were Kyprolis and Pomalyst. And these two got approved within the last 18 months or so. So the single agent response rates are not that exciting with these drugs. So what we are trying to do is to use these drugs in rational combinations. So the big study that was presented at ASH, although it came out as a publication around the same time too. So it happened, the presentation and the publication happened simultaneously, and a lot of people had access to both. So it was the randomized study of carfilzomib, revlimid, dexamethasone versus just revlimid and dexamethasone for relapse disease. So that was presented by Dr. Stewart from the Mayo Clinic in Scottsdale. And this was, again, an international effort across the world. So they randomized patients who were in what we call early relapse, meaning they had not relapsed, they were not relapsed and refractory. Patients had to be still expected to be sensitive to Revlimid. So half the people got just Revlimid and dexamethasone. The other people got Revlimid, dexamethasone, plus Kyprolis. And they had a standard treatment with Kyprolis in addition to Revdex for about a year. And then they had reduced intensity of Kyprolis every other week for about 6 months. And then they stayed on Revlimid maintenance after that. And this is a very effective study. This combination proved to be much better than just Revlimid dexamethasone. People who got Revdex had an average of 17 months before they progressed to needing another treatment, whereas people who got the Kyprolis combination had 26 months. So they had a 9-month progression-free survival advantage and deeper responses and a trend that could be significant for a longer survival, overall survival. So it's not fully significant yet, but it's kind of on the border there. So this was really the major study that was reported in myeloma at ASH, and this was called the ASPIRE study. So this study is already published, so if you want, you could actually look it up at the New England Journal of Medicine from about 2 weeks ago. The other combinations with these drugs are, you know, if you think about the ones that I just mentioned, i.e. Velcade with Pomalyst. There's a study going on where Velcade, Pomalyst, dexamethasone is compared with Velcade, dexamethasone. There is a combination of carfilzomib, pomalidomide, and dexamethasone, or KPD, which has shown outstanding response rates in multiply relapsed patients. And again, I'm sure you all know that panobinostat, which was an HDAC inhibitor that is not yet approved, went before the FDA, and at this time it's still not approved. So relapsed refractory myeloma, the combinations of existing drugs are the way that people will be using this. What is important about the ASPIRE study is that there was a belief that you could just use one or two drugs and then wait for those drugs to fail, then go to a second drug like that. We are increasingly seeing this trend where combinations are turning out to be better than three-drug combinations are getting better than two-drug combinations. The advantage of using the combination is that you get more people into a complete response quickly, and then that translates into a longer time from relapse. So I'm a firm believer in using ideal combinations whenever possible. Obviously, sometimes insurance, sometimes the toxicity, those can be a hindrance, but we need to get quick, deep responses in myeloma whenever we treat it. So, you know, to strike hard when you're striking is kind of one of that philosophy. And I think that it's interesting that both the Taldex versus Velcade Taldex study and the Revdex versus Velcade Revdex study, both of those studies have showed that the three drugs are better than the two drugs, especially in terms of preventing progression. So that's the state of the art in relapse refractory myeloma, is going more and more towards combinations and new drugs. So what are the new drugs that are going to be approved in the near future or going to be looking really promising for the next two? I'm sure you've all heard about the antibodies. There are two big antibodies that are getting all the attention right now, and there are a couple of others that are coming right behind. So the two big ones are daratumumab, which is an anti-CD38 antibody. CD38 is a marker present on the surface of plasma cells. So this antibody, when you inject it into patients, it can go and find out wherever CD38 is on the surface. And that means it will pick out all the myeloma cells, attach to that, those cells only, and kill those cells selectively. So it is targeted. It has very little collateral damage, so it is generally better than chemotherapy. And most antibodies have this problem that when you give it to patients IV, the patients get a reaction. Since it's happening in a doctor's office or in a hospital, you actually have good control over that situation. And over time, the body gets used to it, and the reactions tend to go away. This is common for all antibodies, including Rituxan, which is kind of the most famous antibody in oncology, which is a CD20 antibody used in lymphoma. So we have always been looking for the Rituxan equivalent in myeloma, and we might be getting there now. Another CD38 antibody that's being trialed is a SAR650984, or people call it SAR. But if you said SAR, you know, there are several drugs made by that company, Sanofi, which go by that acronym. So it's SAR650984 is the one in myeloma. It's again an anti-CD38 antibody. There are technical differences between the two antibodies, the daratumumab and the SAR. and they are actually both being tried in relapsed refractory disease with very promising single agent response rates. But we knew about the single agent responses from the previous data already. However, at this ASH, we had data in combination with Revlimid and dexamethasone. So this study from Denmark where they showed a combination of daratumumab with Revlimid and dexamethasone, they had almost 45 patients, and essentially everyone in phase 1 responded, and of the people in the phase 2 part, almost 87% responded to the three-drug combination, and including a lot of patients, almost 50 had a very good partial response or more. This is just unbelievable, the amount of the responses that we are seeing with the combination at this stage. You know, for a relapsed myeloma, getting 50% VGPR is very, very good. And there are some other technical issues with the antibodies. You know, turns out that if you have antibodies-based treatment, sometimes the way we do serum protein electrophoresis and immunofixation may underestimate or overestimate the number of people who are actually in a remission, so there's technical issues with calculating the remissions, and that's because this is an antibody that you give to people. So and so the IFE test may also need to be modified in this situation. Similarly, the combination of SAR650984 with Revlimid is also being explored. So this was a study from UCSF, again a phase 1B study. I think 84% of patients, something like 30 patients who came on that, almost 60% had a very good response. So this is, very exciting news. Interestingly, if you note, it is not single agents, it's the combination that's being explored. I'm sure that these combinations will get approved, and then they will probably move into the frontline setting, probably within the next 3 to 4 years. So we are looking at an exciting phase, a new phase of new classes of drugs that might be available. Finally, the fourth thing that Gary asked me to talk about is things that may be helpful for measurement, early diagnosis, intervention, etc. So we have several different pathways that are branching off at the same time. So we have redefined myeloma definitions. So we are redefining who has myeloma. So people who we used to call high-risk smoldering myeloma, where they were going to get myeloma within a few months or weeks, we have moved a bunch of those people into actual myeloma. So the new criteria for myeloma include anybody with more than 60% plasma cells. They are considered myeloma, whether they have bone disease and calcium anemia, renal problems, etc. Next, we are people with a very high light chain ratio. They're also are considered a myeloma defining feature. People with one or more focal lesions on MRI scans and PET scans, they're also considered myeloma. So we have actually moved some of the people who we used to consider smoldering myeloma into myeloma, so that we are going to benefit those people by early treatment. Second issue is monitoring. So I'm sure you've all heard about minimal residual disease monitoring, and minimal residual disease is something that is very interesting nowadays because we are getting more and more people into complete remissions. When we say somebody is in a complete remission, we mean that we cannot detect, we looked very hard and we could not detect any disease in this. But when we talk minimal residual disease, we are asking the question, how hard did you look? Can you look even harder? So basically, if you're in complete remission by whatever we conventionally define as, then we apply much stronger techniques like flow cytometry or next-gen sequencing, and look even harder, we might be able to find more disease. So we can find disease to the level of one cell in out of 10,000, one cell to out of 100,000. If it's a myeloma cell, we can pick it out. And it turns out that people who are minimal residual disease negative in their bone marrow tend to do better than the people who are minimal residual disease positive, which kind of stands to reason. But then the second part of that question is, can you convert people who are MRD positive into MRD negative and thus improve the survival of patients? So, we thought they were in a CR and they were going to do well, but they didn't do well because they had minimal residual disease. So can we change that by additional treatment, either maintenance, consolidation, additional transplant, etc.? So this is an exciting field, and that is, you're going to hear more about it. But right now it is being used not uniformly, mostly academic centers tend to use it. So those are some of the big things that were in discussion at ASH. So I think, Gary, any questions about this?
New pathways, other drugs other than the ones that do CD38.
Oh, yeah, of course. There are several new drugs in new pathways. So we talked about the antibodies. So we talked. There are a bunch of new what we call small molecules. So the most exciting one was this molecule that's already approved for a disease called CLL and mantle cell lymphoma. This is called ibrutinib or Imbruvica. It's already approved, and it's approved in those two diseases. There was a study presented by my friend Dr. Vidge from Washington University, where they used ibrutinib with dexamethasone for patients with relapsed myeloma. And he had promising response rates in that setting. Interestingly, most drugs that work in mantle cell lymphoma work in myeloma too. And the reverse is also kind of true. So in this study, I think it was about 69 patients included in that study. They had a median of almost 4 treatments before that, so they were all relapsed patients. And the combination achieved a minor response, or meaning like at least 25% decline in paraprotein in 20%, and another 25% it stopped the progression of disease. So the median progression-free survival was about 6 months in that. So it suggests that there is some activity, and there might be scope of using that activity further in combinations. Now, then the second group, there was a study on this other proteasome inhibitor called oprosumib, which again is the same pathway, but a newer drug in that pathway, similar to carfilzomib, but oral. Next, we have a group of drugs known as cyclin-dependent kinase inhibitor, or CDK drugs, that again has been in use for a little bit, but now maybe becoming mainstream in the future. More interestingly, there is a new class being explored called export protein inhibitors or XPO1 inhibitors. This class of drugs seems to be particularly effective for people who have a 17p deletion. Now, as you all know, 17p deletion is a very powerful, bad prognostic factor in myeloma and in any other disease for that matter. So this drug inhibits the export of toxic proteins out of the cell's nucleus, so this proteins that make the cell die accumulate in the nucleus of the cell and kills it off. So this drug it's called selinexor, and it's being explored in myeloma and in other diseases. That was also data presented at ASH. There is a new HDAC6 inhibitor called ricolinostat or risolinostat, which is again being was presented. So the hope is that instead of using pan HDAC inhibitor, which hit across all HDAC enzymes in the body, this drug is a more targeted drug. It hits only HDAC6, which is active in myeloma. So we have several different pathways that are being explored newly. And again, some of them are early, very early in testing.
Fantastic. Well, thank you very much, Doctor. And this excellent presentation is one of the reasons that you're one of my great 8 of myeloma specialists in the world. Pat Killingsworth, are you online?
I am, Gary.
All right, Pat. Your question for Dr. Hari?
Sure. Hello, Doctor. I was pleased to get a chance to meet you at the poster session in ASH. I was with Gary.
Same. Yeah, I remember about Pat. Yeah, pleased to meet you, too. I've heard a lot about you.
Thank you. And I had the pleasure to sit next to somebody else you might know, Dr. Michael Thompson from down in your neck of the woods.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah.
And we started talking about total therapy a little bit. When I was diagnosed in 2007, and total therapy was still sort of a mystical University of Arkansas Medical Center thing that, there wasn't a lot of data supporting it outside of Arkansas, and it was never presented to me as any kind of option. I started at the Mayo Clinic. But now, almost eight years out, I'm in my third relapse, and pomalidomide's working for me, thank goodness, but I'm constantly medicated and starting to run out of options, and I have good friends like Gary right here on the line and a dozen others who are drug-free 3, 4, 5, 6 years out from their total therapy experience. They were all low-risk patients, as was I at the time. And I'm starting to think, with the emphasis on heavily hitting myeloma hard up front, and now with more data possibly supporting total therapy, that it might be an option that a newly diagnosed patient should explore. And I guess I just wondered, when talking to Dr. Thompson, the reason I brought that up is he mentioned selection bias, the fact that only certain patients can make it to Arkansas in order to be treated. But you know, at this point, that just seems to ring a little hollow to me. And I'm not I don't have a Arkansas bias, a total therapy bias, but as an outsider looking in, I just can't believe it's only selection bias that are allowing all of my friends to be running around having practically normal lives without using maintenance therapy at this point in their life. Could you comment about that? And if you agree with that it's the selection bias thing, I mean, I want your honest opinion. I'm not trying to color your answer, but I
sure, yeah.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I see the question. So let me put things in perspective. You know, total therapy went through like three or four versions. It was total therapy 1, 2, 3, and then total therapy light. And there's a couple of different versions of total therapy going on. All of them have been tested exclusively at Arkansas, University of Arkansas Medical Center under Dr. Barlagi, and he has reported outstanding survival in patients who went through that program. That's for sure. There's no question about that. And what Dr. Thompson and others would tell you about total therapy is that it has never been studied in a randomized fashion. So the gold standard of medical, you know, the reason why total therapy is not adopted as is from Arkansas to other centers like Mayo and these other centers that you mentioned is because it has never been studied in a randomized fashion. So why do we know that carfilzomib Rev-Dex is truly better than Revlimid Dex? Because we had, if we had 100 patients in that, we had almost 700 patients in that study. One person got carfilzomib Rev-Dex, the other person got Revlimid Dex, and it was randomized. So you couldn't predict who was going to get what. And at the end of the study, you looked at all the people who got carfilzomib Rev-Dex and the people who got Rev-Dex, and then you looked how many high-risk people were there, how many people had 17p deletion, how many people had, what were the ages, were they comparable? So two groups were comparable. And then the people, so between two comparable groups that had identical myeloma broadly, one group had carfilzomib Rev-Dex, the other group had Rev-Dex only, and the people who got those three drugs lived longer or had a longer progression-free survival. So we now, you know, that's a scientific method. You have to do a randomized study. So the reason why total therapy is not more popular is because it was never done in a randomized fashion where half the people got total therapy and the other half got, say, less therapy, such as, like, you know, induction, transplant, just maintenance. So we don't know if total therapy is better than anything else that we do. So, you know, I have people who are 20 years out and doing great, people who are 10 years out and have never, you know, had any treatment after 6 months. So there's, you know, every center has that. But do we know this is because my treatment is better than total therapy or total therapy is better than my treatment? We don't know that. So unless we do a randomized study, we cannot say that for sure. But it is clear
isn't that something that should be done? Do you know of any ongoing, or has it even been started? And if not, why not? It seems like a logical thing to test.
Excellent, excellent question.
Right. So the thing is, you know, we would, so the other people who wouldn't, you know, so the, so total therapy as it is practiced in Arkansas involved a lot of cumulative chemotherapy, you know, a lot of chemotherapy, multiple
sure.
transplants, all that. And most of us believe that we are able to mimic the same treatments. You know, so what has happened? So which part of total therapy has the rest of the world adopted? We have adopted the approach of strong induction, transplant, post-transplant treatment, maintenance, because in total therapy total therapy 1 did not have a maintenance arm. Total therapy 2 had thalidomide maintenance versus no maintenance. There was randomization at that point. And then total therapy 3, I believe, had Velcade-based maintenance. And even the total therapies that are being used now have some form of additional treatment after you get transplanted. So we have all adopted from that. Dr. Barlagi taught us that if you are going to treat myeloma, you need continuous treatment for a long period of time. And until this everyone else has taken off. You know, so the largest study that was done here nationally across the country was initial treatment, one transplant followed by Revlimid maintenance versus two transplants followed by Revlimid maintenance versus one transplant followed by consolidation with Velcade, Revlimid, dexamethasone followed by maintenance. That is the type of total therapy that we do. We don't use, more chemotherapy, so the people who are getting treatment in Arkansas get more chemo treatments.
Sure, they're getting VDT
pace. VDT
pace
and things like that.
Probably something that they found in the back of some storeroom they're tossing that into.
Yeah.
And the tandem transplant. It drives me nuts, too, the tandem transplants. I know the data is not good for tandem autos, but in the context of total therapy, all of a sudden tandems start to look a lot better. So once again,
it would be nice to
compare total therapy in its totality.
Well, everybody's moving away from chemo, Pat.
Sure,
that's what's
happening.
So, VDT pace is kind of a treatment of last resort for the rest of the world, and that's what's happening. So I use VDT pace probably two or three times a month. That's almost always in people who have extremely high-risk myeloma that's not responding to anything else, or people who have something like plasma cell leukemia where they have really high-risk myeloma.
Yeah.
So
I get it. I understand exactly what you're saying, and I think a lot of our listeners do too, but I get hammered constantly, and I'm not saying total therapy is bad. It would just be nice to know.
Yeah, absolutely. Total therapy is definitely the people who took total therapy, did not have anything to lose, and they didn't lose anything by taking it. They had outstanding results, and like I said, as a single center result, those results are unmatched. They're fantastic results, and we have all adopted from that. We have taken bits and pieces of that. We have not taken it whole, en masse, mainly because it was not done in a randomized fashion. You have to. So the rest of the world to buy in, we have to use it in a. We have to have a randomized control. So when Dr. Thompson said it was selection bias, he meant they didn't have a randomized control.
No, he did mention the randomized part too. It was very.
Yeah.
It was very helpful. Well, great. I'm not going to sit here and beat you up. I'm not. I haven't been drinking the total therapy Kool-Aid, but it just seems like from an outside advisor that they've had some pretty good success.
They've had very good success. Nobody's arguing that. Yeah, exactly.
And if you look at the selection bias, I think the thing is that, and I've heard it from other people too, is that if you can make it to Mayo Rochester, obviously, A, you got money, and B, you're not one of those that got diagnosed late and died in the first 2 months.
Let me tell you, in Milwaukee, if you get myeloma, and you cannot make it anywhere else. That's the first. When I started here, the patients who came here were the people who, if you had money and before the reputation builds up, people who you get are the people who don't want to go anywhere else. And now I get people who can travel. I get people from other states who come here because they have the ability to travel. They've done their research. They already know a lot about the disease, and they can have an informed conversation. But I also get people who live here and who don't know anything. They could be having leukemia or myeloma or whatever. They don't care. They just end up here because they're sick. And then we have to take good care of them. But if you're a tertiary center situated in a far-off city, almost all of the people who show up to you are people who have the ability to travel, who have heard about you, and who've made the investment to travel and be there. So there's a little bit of selection bias going on that way. So you get the best of the best patients.
Well, Doctor, keep up the great work. We appreciate what you do so much.
Yeah, Pat, Dr. Hari has got the opposite of that selection bias.
Right.
Yeah, that makes his numbers even more impressive, Gary.
Yeah, so he's he's on the other extreme, right? He gets
right.
The your haggard searching for right or whatever, and his survival rates are some of the best in the world, so go figure. And also, Dr. Hari, I believe you have, for younger patients, you do induction, transplant, auto, then allo, and then maintenance, right?
That's true.
To try to.
Yeah, so that's something
So
Pat's, I think Pat has that question too. So when are allo transplants an appropriate option for myeloma patients? So our program, there is a little, so what we do uniquely is we do a lot more allo transplants than most patients. And that's because we believe that patients with what we call ultra high risk multiple myeloma, which means patients who present with kidney failure, patients who have high risk markers, people who have progression, they get Velcade, Revlimid, Dex, and they're actually progressing on that treatment. If they have plasma cell leukemia, if they have a auto transplant, good initial treatment, auto transplant, and then within a year, if their myeloma has progressed, those are patients who we don't think can be saved by our current technologies, medical technologies. If we, you know, especially when you have a person who's younger, meaning anybody below the age of 60, then we've been pushing up the age, actually. I'm doing a lot of allos in people between 60 and 65, too, nowadays. We believe an allo transplant might be the option for them. The big problem with allo transplants in myeloma used to be high mortality. In 1993, that was 21 years ago, there was a trial going on in the U.S. where allo was compared against auto and chemotherapy, and the allo arm had to be shut down because of almost prohibitive mortality. In the first month, they managed to kill 30% of patients going through. And, you know, transplants have come a long way since then. Our own mortality at our Center for Allo Transplants for Myeloma is below 5%. It's very, very low. It is still higher than for auto transplants, but it is, you know, it's not the, you know, the 30%, 40% that people think about. That is very old numbers. And even nationally, the numbers have come down to closer to 10% than, you know, those high numbers. At ASH, so just to put things in perspective, in the U.S., we hardly do about 100 allotransplants for myeloma a year. In Europe, they do about 700. So it's seven times more popular in Europe. And the number of myeloma patients are broadly similar across the two countries. So there was a study from Germany that was presented at this time's ASH, where they looked at allotransplants in patients who had high-risk markers, especially those who had 13q deletion. And it suggested that after, this was a very, very long follow-up, almost 8 years of follow-up, people who got the auto transplant followed by allo had a longer progression-free survival, and it didn't matter whether they had a sibling match or if they had an unrelated donor. So that was actually a good result for people who had high-risk markers. And at this time, we are restricting this allotransplant approach to people who have only high-risk markers or people who relapse very quickly following an autotransplant. And I think it still has an option. It is more a poor man's immune therapy right now. You know, our immune therapies in myeloma are going to get better in the next 10 to 15 years, I think, you know, especially with CAR T-cells and many other technologies that are coming along, vaccination approaches. So ultimately, you have to teach your immune system to live with the myeloma or control it. And that's why, you know, we all know that people who have MGUS, which is early, very, very early myeloma or, you know, a pre-myeloma condition, they can live forever. You know, the vast majority don't ever go to myeloma. That's because their immune systems can keep myeloma under check. So the allotransplant gives you a new immune system from the donor. And that is why it works sometimes. But it doesn't work in everybody. We still have a lot of progress to make in that. But if we can get rid of the mortality associated with allotransplant and make it safer, more people can undergo that. That's been my philosophy in using it for especially younger people with very, very bad disease.
Thank you, Doctor. Gary, you better get on
yep.
to some of our other...
Get on to Jack. Yeah. Jack, you online?
I am. And I have that was fascinating, the comment about the low mortality rate with allos. Can I just ask a follow-up to that, though?
Sure. Yes.
Are these minis or fulls? Are they T cell depleted or non T cell depleted? What makes the mortality so low?
So I do either fulls or kind of in betweens. We don't do minis anymore. So we did a mini study between 2002 and 2007, where we did really, really mini transplants, and those patients we had very low mortality. That's how we learned to get rid of the mortality. But then we found that relapse rates were still high, not as low as they are now. So what we did was we amplified the conditioning regimen to somewhere in between mini and full intensity for patients who are older. And for if you're really young, I do full intensity transplants. They are not T-depleted because I want the T-cells in there to fight the myeloma. There are two approaches. You can actually T-deplete and do the transplants and then give the T-cells later as what we call donor leukocytes. We don't do that. We do donor leukocytes if patients relapse after an allo. But then we also use maintenance approaches to boost the immunity afterwards. So we did a study with Revlimid, and we have a new study that's being planned, which should come online nationally within the next within the next 3 or 4 months, we'll have the national study of allo for high-risk myeloma open.
Well, that's really impressive. I have to adjust my comments when I talk to people about allos.
Right. I believe you're an allo survivor.
I am, yeah. So so I'm really glad to hear it, because when I got mine back in 98, there was a 40% mortality rate, which
right,
typically...
exactly. Yeah, exactly. That has gone away. And so did you ever
but
relapse
it's not
following
gone away
the ALO?
For everybody. Has it, doctor? I'm sorry. It hasn't gone away for everybody, because I look at the information on, you know, Be the Match, and or one of those things that shows all the allo transplants, and there's still places that are having 30 to 40% 1 year.
Yeah, but that's, you know, for leukemia and everything else, you see. So there's,
oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, it's not, you know, very few places do enough myeloma allo transplants. There's probably, I told you about 85, 90 transplants being done in, for myeloma in the country, and almost all of them are at like 7 or 8 centers. That's it.
Yeah.
So everybody does that if a little bit. We happen to be one of the bigger places, yeah, for this.
So the question I was going to ask, and I'll still ask it, is that for the last couple of 3 years now, I've heard that one day we are really going to be able to say there are 8 or 9 different myelomas.
Yes.
Ultimately, the goal is to understand what treatment works for which myeloma.
Correct.
And I want to know how, I assume we don't know what those 8 or 9 are now, and I assume that's not by FISH or cytogenetics and high risk. I don't know if it's, we're going to find them out with respect to genomic analysis or gene expression profiling or markers that we look at, flow cytometry and such. What's your guess on how we're going to be able to determine those 8 or 9 different myelomas?
So these 8 or 9 different myelomas, we have a glimpse of what they are now. So it is not just one thing. You're right. So right now we just put them in two buckets, high risk and low risk, and we define high risk a certain way and low risk a certain way. And that's going to change over time because, you know, so what translocation of chromosomes 4 and 14 used to be a very high risk marker. But we found out that that is a exquisitely Velcade sensitive or proteasome inhibitor sensitive myeloma. So patients who get this myeloma, who if you get diagnosed correctly and you know that your doctor knows that you have it, they use a Velcade based approach. They use Velcade in maintenance, and that those patients now tend to do just as well as patients who don't have 414. So we have converted what was a high risk marker by knowing more about that marker and knowing how to treat it, we have converted them to a standard risk or an intermediate risk now. So this is going to happen. So this 8 or 9 different types of myeloma, maybe let's say there are 6 different kinds of myeloma, and we will be treating them differently. So lymphoma is a classic example. We had one lymphoma, you know, 30 years ago. Now we have 45 different kinds of lymphoma, and there are subclassifications of lymphoma. So the combination of things such as flow cytometry, the genetics of the myeloma itself, what genes are expressed, what is the driver mutation that causes it, what are the acquired abnormalities that come on top of it, those are the things that define each type of myeloma. And that definition is going to get refined as time goes on. Right now, I would broadly place people into people who have translocations, which are good, such as translocation 11-14, that's one group. People who have trisomies, those people tend to be very sensitive to IMiDs like Revlimid, Thalidomide, Pomalidomide. That would be one group. People who have 17p deleted disease would be another group. People who have high-risk translocations like 414, 1420, 1416 would go another group. And then people who have chromosome 1 amplifications would be another group. So those are the, you know, some of the one way you can think about this. But that's just a crude method. And like I said, not everyone's FISH test is positive. So there's some people who are unclassifiable by that technique. So we will have to do more, you know, reliable techniques to classify these people. And that's only going to get better with time. But more importantly, if we classify people rightly, we can choose the right drugs for them. And that is what's going to make a difference in the lives of people.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jack. Cindy, you online?
I'm here.
So
can you
nice
hear me?
So nice to meet you, Cindy. Yes.
Okay.
Your question.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Hari, for everything. It's a very enlightening conversation tonight. Sorry I didn't get to meet you at ASH this year, but maybe I will next year.
Maybe next year, yeah.
My question revolves around MRD. We hear, I guess that's kind of a hot topic, myeloma now. And I'm hearing that maybe even some of the clinical trials now we're starting to use MRD as an endpoint. But I'm also hearing there's different ways to measure MRD.
Yes.
Can you explain, like, the different ways? I've heard about flow, maybe next gen integration sequencing, the heavy lights. I even heard MRD negative from some type of imaging test. And are these tests clinically available now? If they are, should I be asking my doctor to do MRD testing on me? If yes, when should it be done? If I'm negative now, will I always be negative? There's just a lot of questions about MRD. So if you could just talk a little bit about that topic.
Sure. So you ask a very tough question. It's a matter of debate, actually. Like I said, if you have, you know, MRD is just a way of measuring very, very low levels of disease. So when we say somebody is in a complete remission, which it means that we looked very hard to find out if they had myeloma, and we found that we found no myeloma. So when we say somebody is MRD negative, it is basically a way of saying we looked even harder than we normally look, and we found they're negative. And it stands to reason, just as people who are in complete remission tend to do better than people who do not get to a complete remission. Similarly, people who are MRD negative, they tend to do better than people who are MRD positive. So whichever the way of looking, if you are negative by that way of looking, you tend to do better than the people who are positive. So that's very, very obvious, right? There are two different places that you look for. Number one is in the bone marrow. So the advantage of the bone marrow is that's where the action is for the vast majority of people. So you do a bone marrow biopsy and look for plasma cells. That is the myeloma cell. So, and if you can, normally if you have 5% or less plasma cells, you call it a complete remission. If you are 0% plasma cells, you call it a stringent complete remission. So so MRD in the bone marrow is really only useful for people who are in a stringent complete remission, where you didn't find anything when your normal way of looking. Then, in the normal way of looking, we count 500 plasma cells, 500 cells, and if you didn't find any plasma cells in those cells, then you say, okay, I looked for 500 cells and I didn't find any. That's great. If you do MRD, the most common technique of using it, which is very widely available across the country, is flow cytometry. That means you take a tube of bone marrow, you put it in a liquid bone marrow, you separate out the cells, and you flow them around a tube, there are sensors which pick up certain colors from these cells. Actually, you have to coat them with antibodies before, and then you flow it in a tube, and it picks up the colors. You shine a light. The reflection tells you which cells are plasma cells. So you can flow like 100,000 cells. You can flow a million cells across the tube very quickly, and then you can count how many plasma cells. And that technique is sensitive to the tune of 1 in 10,000. So if you have one plasma cell among 10,000, that's sensitive. So obviously a person cannot sit around a microscope and count 10,000 cells. So this is more sensitive. The next technique that came along is for something called the ASOPCR, which is sensitive to the technique of about 1 in 100,000. So it's even a little bit more sensitive. But the problem with that technique is you need to know what is the signature of myeloma in that particular person. So you have to have a tissue from diagnosis, then you have to follow the person a long time, and it's more cumbersome. It takes 5 or 6 days to do it, and it's individual specific. So each person, there's a lot of work they have to do on that particular person's myeloma. So it's not widely applicable. The latest technique that came along is what we call next generation sequencing. And as you all know, genetics advances mean that sequencing costs have come down dramatically. And so it may become the technique of the future. It's not right now the technique of the future. We can do it right now. There are tech companies that will do it for you for about $2,000. And they promise that they will not charge the patient. So sometimes I do send it in some of my patients, especially when we did when we're trying to really cure the person or we're trying to get to nothing in their marrow. So this is sensitive to the tune of almost a 1 in a million cells. So if you have a million, so it's like counting a million cells in the bone marrow and saying there was not even one plasma cell among that million cells. So it turns out that if you're MRD negative, your chances of relapse are lower. Or when you relapse, tend to relapse much later than people who are MRD positive. So, but at this time, we have not gone to any level of MRD at which we can say this person, because he is MRD negative at next generation sequencing, he is never going to relapse. We have not gone to that level. So eventually in the future, we might get to a level of technique where we say, okay, this person is so negative that he is not going to relapse. So he doesn't need any more treatment at this point. So that would be one use of having an MRD. And we can come to a level where we can say, it is so sensitive, my technique is so sensitive that people who are negative by that technique, they're not going to relapse. Then that will be very useful for patients. But we are not there yet, but I'm hoping that we'll be there in the future. The second advantage is if you do the same treatment to, say, 10 individuals, and you find that, you know, this particular treatment, it gets 8 of those people MRD negative. Another treatment would have, you know, similar group of people. Another treatment gets only 4 of these people MRD negative. You can compare treatments. You can say which treatment is going to get you more MRD negative patients. That is a surrogate for long-term benefit. So that's why all of the clinical trials now, they have to have MRD in there. Otherwise, you know, we don't, you know, we'll say, how many people did you really get MRD negative? That means, you know, you have an early signal as to which treatment is going to be long-term more effective. But there are people who argue that MRD is not all that it is touted up to be. And this is the reason for that, you know. So we know that you can live with myeloma, right? If you have, there are many people who never get into a complete remission. So they don't even, the question of MRD doesn't even arise in them. They have a little bit of M protein left after all the treatment they had. But then, and they're also going to have a 10-year remission or an 8-year remission or even never come out of relapse. They are almost going back into a smoldering myeloma state. It's as if their immune system is actually taking care of that little myeloma that is left behind. So if you're going to live with that little myeloma, you don't even need to get into a complete remission. So the people who are, you know, who are saying, okay, MRD is a hype, it is not all that's hyped up to be, but it is true that you can actually be okay even if you have MRD positivity. So I wouldn't rush into judgment on MRD. Eventually, if you're going to cure everybody with myeloma, we need to have treatments that will give us MRD negative. So that is the ultimate test of getting rid of every single myeloma cell in the person's body. That will be proven by MRD only. But it is not necessary to be MRD negative in every person for them to have a long life. I hope that's
fantastic. Thank you so much, Doctor.
That sounds good. Just one follow-up question. With
we're over right now, Cindy.
You can email me if you have questions.
Hari,
okay, I will email.
I was going to ask Dr. Hari if you had a few extra minutes to take calls from our viewers. That would be great.
I do. Yeah.
Okay. And Cindy, did you still want to ask that question?
Well, if you have calls coming in, go ahead and ask those calls.
Okay, and then if there's time left over, we'll have you come back in. All right, Priya, could you call for some callers?
Callers, if you have a question for Dr. Hari, please press 1 on your keypads, and we can bring you live on air to ask your question. Dr. Hari, we have received some submitted questions, and there's just one which came by email right now.
Okay.
It says, can you speak on any new information about genomic profiling progress reported at the ASH?
So genomic profiling, I did not actually see a lot more at genomic profiling. There is a group, the Multiple Myeloma Research Foundation, has a genomic profiling approach known as the COMPASS program, and they did report some of the mutations that are important for patients with multiple myeloma. This was actually started a while ago, and they've already had some high profile publications. At this time, you know, we don't have any actionable items from that, but you know, the interim analysis for that study was actually presented at ASH. That was the only thing, and I think it was presented last year. I don't remember anything from this year. But there are some mutations like NRAS, KRAS, BRAF mutations that were found in myeloma patients, and especially the recurrent fusion gene that was very significant was the classic 414 translocation gene. So that was another finding. But I'm sorry, I don't remember anything that was like actionable intelligence from there, unfortunately. It may have been just me. You know, it's such a big meeting, you don't get to everything sometimes.
There's another question. Kate has been asking, consolidation after auto stem cell transplant is showing promise for patients of all risk levels. The data is often for newly diagnosed patients. What is the data and experience indicating for previously treated patients, that is patients who delayed the auto transplants and had consolidation with it?
So the question is, if patients had auto transplant after prior treatment and, you know, then they relapse, what are the data, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So these are patients who have delayed transplants, or, you know, so there are two ways in which you can have an autotransplanted relapse. One is you never had an autotransplant up front. You had initial chemotherapy induction treatment and you were going along, and then you relapsed at some point, and then you are having an autotransplant at that point. So it turns out that autotransplants are equally effective at that stage. In fact, overall survival data would indicate that early transplant versus late transplant has similar outcomes overall for the patient. Unfortunately, the most recent study that came out was Dr. Palumbo's study from Italy, where the approach was initial transplant in patients in half the patients, and the other half was to the plan was to do a delayed transplant. But only about two-thirds of the patients who were planning to have a delayed transplant actually ended up getting a transplant. So that was one problem. So if you think your transplant is going to be happening later on in life, you know, 2 or 3 years into the disease, sometimes you don't even get to it because of something else happening. You know, life happens. You know, you may get a complication. You may get some other illness which precludes transplantation. So people didn't get it. And then in this particular study, though, the people who got early transplant actually did better. So there is some advantage that if you're able to have a transplant, current data suggests that you should try to do it sooner, and that is also my personal bias. However, if you are able to get a second transplant later, the data are that you tend to have a good long overall survival. And the other group who gets a delayed transplant are the people who had an auto transplant at the beginning. Then they relapse later on. So then you do a second auto transplant at relapse. For that group, we call that a salvage second transplant, and there is a lot of interest in doing this now. Many people believe that when people relapse, we should approach it as we approach initial disease, newly diagnosed disease. So you give good induction treatment at relapse, you get them into a good remission, and do a transplant and do different drugs as maintenance. And that is going to be tested in randomized trials very soon. We had several meetings about this within the last 6 months or so, and I think we will have some trials going on about that. So I think there is some value to using a transplant-based approach, especially in people who had benefited from a transplant upfront.
Thank you, Dr. Hari. Cindy, I think we can just squeeze in your question and then wind up for today.
Okay. My question was just back with the MRD again.
Yeah.
I was talking to, one of the companies that do MRD testing, Sequentia. They do the clonal site testing. And they were mentioning something, though, that their test is a two-part test, and the first part of the test, they need to have a sample of your bone tissue from initial diagnosis.
Right.
Do you explain something about that?
Correct.
And are those samples, like when my sample, since I was diagnosed 6 years ago, kept somewhere that they could access it? So could you explain what that means?
Yeah, so there is what you say is very true. So when you do a genetic test, your myeloma has a particular genetic signature, okay? So the genetic signature of your myeloma is unique to you as a patient. So if they're going to look at a million cells DNA and find out that signature, then that's when they call you MRD positive. So they need to know what the signature is. So they need tissue from when you had myeloma for sure. If you're in a complete remission right now and you have, you know, if you're truly MRD negative, they don't know what to look for. So it is for them to figure out what to look for. So many a time, you know, the lab which did your original bone marrow biopsy will have some tissue left behind from that. They can even do it off the slides that you have. You know, the good thing about DNA is, you know, they can test small amounts even in very little tissue. They can do it from mummies in Egypt, right? So they can a little bit of blood or tissue is all you need. So if you have a bone marrow slide from when you were diagnosed, you have a little paraffin block from when you were diagnosed, that should be enough. The other option is to, you know, if you have any time you relapse or something, you send them that tissue whenever you get that tissue. When you have known myeloma, you send the tissue to them, and then they have that signature which they can follow forever.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dr. Hari. I think that was a whole lot of information that you shared with us today.
Thank you.
It was absolutely great listening to you. Thank you very much for your time. Gary, Pat, Cindy, and Jack, thank you all. The link for today's broadcast will be shared with all our participants. Please visit curetalks.com to register for upcoming shows. Until then, thank you.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Dr. Hari.
Thanks,
Priya.
Thanks, everybody.
Job.
Bye-bye.